Back at it, you and I chatting it up on Tuesday, August the 20th, 2024, right here on Connecticut Today. We talked about the ongoing anger connected to many electric bills in the state with Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio. Landmark Legal Foundation attorney and VP of Legal Affairs Mike O'Neill explained the current federal court battle going on over Title IX. Every Tuesday this time, Megan Portfolio joins us from the Yankee Institute. She pens the Hartford Portfolio blog every few days. Megan, how are you?
Well, it was fine until you started talking about criminals being let out.
Well, I have a couple of stories that from the New York Post. I'm going to do that in my final segment here that will, as I like to say, it'll make your hair hurt. I mean, that's how bad these are. Again, the typical, Megan, you know, long rap sheets and judges in New York undoing the work that the law enforcement does and says, we'll let them out. We don't have to hold these people. So that's my daily dose of agita. But let's talk about a little more agita, Megan. And, you know, people got mad enough. They stopped the tolls. People got mad enough. They, for now, stopped the EV mandate. And now, Megan, it looks like maybe they might be getting a little mad enough to finally force some legislators into doing maybe not the perfect thing, but doing something about the electric bills. And now they're asking questions, are they not, about why are we paying for these EV chargers?
Yes. Yeah, so I don't know if you saw this in the news, but last week it was announced that we will see yet another rate hike coming starting September 1st. And after looking into it, because I had to actually spend hours and hours going through these horrible documents, and you think CTN is boring, this is even more boring. So I spent all these hours going through documents because the meeting where they determine this rate hike, PURA determines this, it was about 9 minutes, of which 5 minutes was just for this vote to increase our rates again. And the utilities are looking to recoup about $80 million, which has been used to give out incentives or welfare for EV chargers, for residential, for multifamily, and for workplace. And the funny, not funny, haha funny, but the funny thing is, PURA didn't have to initiate this whole incentive program. They created it. They didn't have to go to the legislature. The legislature didn't do it. PURA has so much power that they can just invent programs. And they want to have us all drive in these EV cars. So one of their brilliant ideas was, let's include incentives. So I was actually able to find a document that actually broke out the residential portion for the single family homes of who was receiving the incentives. And surprise, surprise, they're all going to the wealthier the towns in the state.
Shocking. I'm just shocked, aren't you?
No, because I've reported on this in the past with these dopey incentives. They were handing them out for e-bikes, and it was all the rich towns that were getting it. Because normal people don't ride around on electric bikes because we've got bills to pay and electric bills to pay.
Yeah, and Megan, here's the thing, and I've been talking about this, and think about this from a broader point of view, and you probably have. Listen, I have nothing against EVs. The technology gets better and better. What I keep saying is let the market dictate. Those who can afford to and buy the EVs do. Some use them for primary vehicles, some they're secondary vehicles. But you know, Megan, you have tax breaks sometimes from the feds. You have tax breaks sometimes from the state. You have no federal or state level gasoline taxes being paid. There's no road use tax, and all in the guise of, hey, you're helping the environment. I mean, look, I'm all for people buying what they want to buy. But when's the free ride literally going to end here? When is this going to end?
Why is the government even involved in this? People will buy things that they want to buy.
Yeah.
We don't need mommy and daddy government coming in to tell me what I mean, they do it enough. Like, I have to purchase car insurance. I have to have this. I have to have that. Like, you don't need to tell me what kind of consumer products I should be buying. Mm-hmm. And you keep putting these incentives in there. Where's the incentive for the automobile companies to start lowering their price and, you know, adjusting their manufacturing so they can make the cars cheaper, so they can sell it to us cheaper? So you're basically keeping the prices high on these cars because the companies know they're going to get these incentives. Like, just stop it already. And they're not, it's like they want to help the poor people, which is, that's nice and all, but you're not, because poor people can't afford brand new cars.
Exactly.
And then people in the cities, where are they going to charge it? I talked to a guy in the north end of Hartford. He literally has to drive to the Buckland Hose Mall to charge his car because there's no place to charge it. So why are we doing this nonsense? And more importantly, why does an unelected group of bureaucrats get to just create these programs without legislative oversight? Why do they have this power?
Well, that's,
and what's really scary is they're part of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection.
Yes. And that's
the commissioner over there has been begging for more power to be able to do whatever the heck she wants. So if this is just an indication of what will happen if she gets this power, we'll all be taking the bus. There'll be no cars.
And I wonder, Megan Portfolio, if the real reason, and you probably saw that piece today in the Day of New London where, you know, Kathy Austin, after the governor said he'd be open to a special session with the Republicans, you know, Kathy Austin saying, well, you know, we're not sure about that. I'm paraphrasing. And a lot of this stuff is. So, you know, I wonder if part of the reason the majority Democrats in Hartford are a little wishy-washy on this is they don't want a lot of people more to hear and find out that so many of these rate increases, well, not so many of them, all of them for public utilities are essentially okayed or knocked down by a bunch of, as you like to say, unelected bureaucrats who don't ever have to face voters. I'm sure they're not comfortable with that either.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, we've got elections in how many days? Of course. I mean, of course, they don't want to face it until after the election's over. But let's be honest. I'm not really sure what they can do. They've allowed this to happen. They've allowed this entity to make up their rules. I mean, the utility companies, and I'm not trying to make them out to be like innocent angels, but in this instance, you know, they're just doing what they're mandated to do.
Yeah.
They asked for these rate increases to happen a while ago. So it would have been actually like a smaller increase that the ratepayers would have seen instead of like this huge dump that they did on our bills this month. And they didn't want to do it for some reason. I don't know why. Was it because there was all of these environmental bills that were, you know, that they were trying to push along? And if you've already got high electric rates and rate hikes, I mean, you're going to get you see how mad the people are. Did they want these bills to pass and that's why they held off? Like, why didn't you just have it like these small increments? I mean, we owe the money. There's nothing. I mean, I don't think it's going to be able to go away, but they do need, if they can't do it in a special session, when they come back, one of the priorities better be to rein in the power that PURA has. Because they shouldn't be allowed to do this without any kind of oversight or checks and balances.
Yeah, and they need to, again, and people and voters need to be more into local races. I know they're not sexy. It's not like the governor's race or the presidential race, which is, you know, a binary choice, A or B, Yankees or Red Sox. We get it. We understand that. But they need to be more into this and understand. And along with that, Megan, not be content with hearing from the General Assembly, well, this is complicated and it's not. I love this one, Megan. Well, it's not as simple as people make it out to be. Okay, it's not. We pay you to figure this stuff out that doesn't screw us. Figure it out.
You're making my hair hurt. Figure it out. And you know what? Don't talk to us like we're stupid because, you know, I've lived in Connecticut most of my life. The voters, you know, are not dumb. Like, if you talk to us and tell us what's going on, we can understand you. We've all gone to our great public schools. We can read. We can comprehend. Just explain it to us. Stop hiding. Stop giving over your power. Like, you people, you run for these elections to take this position of power and you turn it over to a bureaucrat. Why are you even in office then?
And then
Go be a bureaucrat.
Well, yeah, Megan. And finally here, I guess the catch-22 here that I've been, you know, that you and I have both read about and talked about and reported about as well. If these, you know, companies like UI or Eversource, not to fault them, but, you know, if we deny their rate increases, then they're going to come back and say, well, you know, we can't recover our costs here. So that means we're not going to do anything with EV chargers and stuff. So, you know, I don't envy the people that have to make the decisions on this. It's just that to me, the framework kind of engenders this. You know what I mean? And again, I'm no expert here. I would think there's a better way, though. Prove to me, if you're a legislator, convince me there isn't. You know what I mean?
And that's fine. If there's not, just be honest and transparent. We shouldn't have to have petitions. Like, you guys, they should be all over this. Like, they all pay electric bills. Some of them even own businesses, and I can't even imagine what those bills are like. Mm-hmm. So they knew this was coming. Just be transparent and, like, tell us what's going on. I shouldn't have to open up my bill. Well, I didn't. Well, I kind of knew it was coming, so yeah. I didn't open up my bill until the last minute.
Yeah, you told me. Like,
I didn't want to open up my bill and be like, what the heck? And that's what people yeah. did. Most people just pay. You know, they're not writing out checks anymore. You just automatic. Yeah. I don't do automatic pay because yeah. I'm paranoid. But, you know, they do automatic pay. And if you don't look at your bill, you don't know where the money's going. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. People all of a sudden like, why is my bill so high? And they mm-hmm. looked at it and they're freaking out. Well, that's what happens when you're not transparent with us. Like, be honest, be transparent, and rein in Pura, please, for the love of God.
All right. Megan Portfolio writes the Hartford Portfolio blog of the Yankee Institute. Megan, thanks. And we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
All right. Have a good night.
Thanks.
Bye.
You too. Megan Portfolio there from the Hartford Portfolio. Welcoming back one of our go-to guys when it comes to interpreting things going on nationally, primarily at the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court, a landmark legal foundation attorney and VP of Legal Affairs, Mike O'Neill, joins us. Mike, as always, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it. How are you?
I'm well, Paul. How are you?
Very good, Mike. And I thought of you and I thought of some other folks reading about, I guess, pretty quietly over the weekend, I think late last week or over the weekend.
Friday,
the Supreme Court voting 5-4. Now, it's a case involving Title IX. And, Mike, for most of my audience and talk radio audiences, they remember Title IX. I think 1972 it was put into place. And what the long view of Title IX is that it was a seminal moment guaranteeing that women had equal access, particularly other things too, but particularly in athletics on the high school and on the college scene. And that really kind of initiated the real growth of varsity women's athletics in college. So why is this controversial now, Mike O'Neill? What's happening here?
Right. Well, it's funny. You saw the Olympics. I watched the Olympics. I'm sure you did, Paul. And you saw all of the amazing athletics displays from women from colleges who are at colleges. You saw swimmers, gymnasts, basketball players. Invariably, you'd see a track athlete, a female track athlete running for USC. You know, she ran for USC. She currently runs for USC. Went out and burned the track up in a 400-meter race. So Title IX, really, as you said, it kind of was a watershed moment for women's athletics in our country. And you're seeing the fruition of this now in the decade since, 52 years later. You're seeing in the Olympics, you're seeing women's basketball, you're seeing Caitlin Clark, you're seeing the place that women have carved out for themselves in women in the athletic realm. Mm-hmm. Of course, in other extent, in the educational realm,
sure.
et cetera. But what happened, so that is really, that traces its origins back to the implementation of these Title IX in the education amendments from 1972. Well, what happened was, earlier this summer, the Biden-Harris administration promulgated a massive new regulation that instituted really a sea change in how Title IX is administered. And what they did was they included transgender individuals within the ambient of the Title IX protection. So this regulation, again, this is a regulation. This is from the Department of Education. This isn't a law passed by Congress, distinct from the law that was actually enacted in 1972. Mm-hmm. This is a regulation promulgated by the Department of Education that really changes the fundamental approach and fundamental aspects of Title IX to include transgender athletes or transgender individuals. So it prohibited this rule, prohibits sex discrimination based on gender identity, says schools that violate schools, that is universities, colleges, and any school that receives federal funds, violate Title IX when they ban transgender individuals from using bathrooms and locker rooms consistent with their gender identity. And it also includes in the definition of a hostile environment, harassment of individuals based on gender identity. So you could interpret that third provision to saying if you're using the wrong pronouns, that could be considered a hostile environment and harassment and subject an individual to an investigation by the Department of Education. So it's really a sea change in the law via a regulation from mm-hmm. the Department of Education.
Now, I saw the Supreme Court came down with a 5-4 vote, a one-vote margin. What did the court say, and did they kind of say, they didn't really put this to bed, Mike, did they? But
no.
they knocked it back down to another branch of the court. What did they do here?
Right. So how this came up, this is interesting because normally I talk to you in October when these cases are coming around in their merits. This is an August decision. The court's in recess. So this comes up via the shadow docket that we talk about here. And this has come up with a temporary remedy here. This is we're dealing with an injunction. So what happened? Let me just give you the quick version of how this got up to the Supreme Court. So the Department of Education finalizes this regulation. It's challenged immediately in federal district court. Again, those are the trial level courts at the federal level. The federal district courts in the Fifth and Sixth Circuits, respectively, issue an injunction, in other words, prohibit enforcement of this regulation. They say, look, they hold a hearing and they look at the reg and they say, hey, this regulation, the Department of Education doesn't have the statutory authority. And you and I have talked about the statutory authority that these administrative agencies have to have. The Department of Education doesn't have the authority under the law, under Title IX, to promulgate these massive regulations, this sea change regulation, to redefine these statutory terms. Mm-hmm. So they halt implementation in their respective jurisdictions. Fifth and Sixth Circuit Courts of Appeals hear the appeal immediately because it's an injunction. It goes right up to them in an emergency appeal basis in a matter of weeks. Goes to the Fifth and Sixth Circuits, respectively. Those courts here, again, decide whether those lower courts, those district courts, created an error. They did not. Signs off on it, says the lower court did not err. Then again, those Fifth and Sixth Circuits decisions are subject to an immediate appeal to the United States Supreme Court, who then just looks at it from, again, I'm not going to say superficial, but from an emergency posture and says, did the Fifth and Sixth Circuit err in upholding those injunctions that the district court issued prohibiting enforcement? So that's how it goes up fast. And then the 5-4 decision, let me be clear on what that 5-4 decision was. Those four justices did not agree, didn't get to the policy, the actual authority. The disagreement between those justices, and incidentally, Justice Gorsuch was in that four justice number. They disagreed on severability issue. So the lower courts had issued an injunction against enforcement of the entire regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a lot of provisions in it. Those four justices said, look, we think that the three provisions that I talked to you about, the ones regarding the discrimination, the bathrooms, and then the hostile environment, they believe that those provisions could be segregated out and halted those implementations. All the justices agreed that those three provisions were well beyond the authority of the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
What they said was they disagreed on severability, which is kind of a technical issue. So right now, at least in the Fifth and Sixth Circuits Courts of Appeals, again, that's Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, this regulation is not enforceable right now. It's on hold.
Mike O'Neill, the guest, a Landmark Legal Foundation attorney and VP of Legal Affairs. So, Mike, for a non-legal dummy like me, this sounds like because you're the expert here. No, but
don't interpret that. I'm following you. Okay. I don't agree that you're not.
Oh, okay. Well, self-deprecating it sells when you're a talk show host. No, but seriously, this sounds like another. And correct me if I'm wrong here. Another case of, well, if you think the law should be changed, do it legislatively. Don't do it by fiat. Is that what we have here or not?
You're 100% right, Paul. Absolutely. This is, again, another case where you're seeing the current administration trying to effectuate their change via the regulatory process, and that's not how it operates under our system of government. And what you're seeing here is, again, the sea change in how administrative law cases are litigated. The courts are no longer going to just say, hey, look, administrative agencies, you can say what the law is. No, no, no. Under our system of governments, they recognize separation of powers, that it's the legislature's job to change this. And if you want to change Title IX, the law, then who's the body in our government, under our system of government, who's equipped, who's empowered to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Under our Constitution, that's Congress. If Congress is going to make these changes to the law, then so be it. But again, that's ostensibly to reflect the political will behind that.
Yeah.
You don't have bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. making these sea changes of the law unilaterally and without any kind of oversight or any kind of accountability.
So when Title IX was first initiated, Mike, this was done legislatively. This was not done by any sort of executive order?
No, right. Title IX is part of the Education Act, Education Amendments. It's a law. It's a law enacted. You know, it's there encoded in the United States Code. And again, if you want to fundamentally remember how we talk about this. We talk about all these administrative law cases. Administrative agencies now can only function with the authority granted to them via Congress. And Congress never said to the Department of Education, you can redefine sex.
Yeah.
You know, sex has a definition. And think about it. If 1972, these issues were never on board, you know, the Congress in 1972 never considered transgender athletes or biological males identifying as females competing in female sports. That was never even contemplated. So if I'm not saying I want this, obviously I disagree with this from a policy standpoint, mm-hmm. but if this change needs to be effectuated, it needs to be effectuated via the legislative process through Congress.
Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation attorney, VP of Legal Affairs. Mike, as always, thanks for the explanation. We appreciate it. We'll talk down the road. Thanks, Mike.
Yep, Paul, take care.
Appreciate it. There you go.